has made nationalism a bad word. Demonizing putting your country first, even though it was built on the basis of it, has now become a political faux pas, which could even land someone in the same category as being racist, homophobic, or anti-Semitic. Now, the formation of groups like NATO or the World Health Organization are leading the world down a very familiar path, one which could possibly end in World War III. But this is not the goal of all countries. China is putting themselves first and seeing their country grow. Switzerland refuses to become involved in world affairs. Brexit was the outcome of the UK trying to put themselves first. Now, leading into the movement is Scotland, who is actually trying to reestablish its own identity, all with a push for independence from the UK. Even though some would argue it's so that it can rejoin the EU. I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to find the answer on if nationalism deserves the bad name, and if the goal of reducing pride in one's own country is more about preparing the citizens to accept their global place. Is nationalism being taught as evil in today's society? Well, it turns out it just depends on who you ask. Well, our international correspondent Roxana Solano finds out if nationalism is dead or saving the countries who embrace it.
Scotty, to begin to discuss nationalism, we have to start with explaining globalism. In World War II, we saw the negative effects of nationalism as Nazi Germany used it as an excuse to eliminate the Jews. Italy's wish to unify the country with nationalism in the 1900s led to the dictatorship rule of Mussolini. Nationalism is defined as the support for your nation's interest, even if it comes at the detriment of other countries or people. However, in World War II, Hitler in Nazi Germany and Mussolini in Italy turned the idea of nationalism into believing one race or people of one country are superior to another. What was once having pride in your country became tainted by war and genocide. Countries failed to fight discrimination, they had to adopt a globalist identity. We saw the implementation of organizations like NATO, WHO, and the United Nations. Globalism can be defined as the banding together of countries to share ideas, medical advancement, trade of natural resources, and homogeneous immigration policy. Has the world overreacted, trying to make up for the sins of the past? Now we're seeing the United States and the EU go in the opposite direction with globalism. The US open border policy has led to political rift in the country. The European Union precedent of accepting refugees from anywhere has pushed Britain to a breaking point. According to Pew Research, this led to the rise of leaders like Boris Johnson and Donald Trump as people began to feel left behind. Pew Research also did a study showing Western countries in Europe and the United States feel in order to combat racism and discrimination, they must adopt a more inclusive identity. During their surveys, Pew Research found many people mislabeled discrimination as nationalism, leading many countries to not only adopt a more globalist approach, but also have less pride in their own country. But these views mainly differ along party lines. When comparing the UK, US, France, and Germany, those identified as conservative are three times more likely to say they are proud of their country most of the time, compared to those on the left who lean more liberal. On the other side of the world, people in India were surveyed to highly attach religion and language to their feeling of nationalism. While India has dozens of different languages, Pew Research found two-thirds of Hindu Indians felt not only practicing the Hindu religion, but also speaking Hindu are very important to be truly considered Indian. Other groups, including 47% of Muslims, also agree speaking Hindu is what makes a person Indian. China is taking many steps to teach nationalism in schools. Not only are students learning to love their country, but China's education ministry has made a plan to ramp up physical education classes and hire more male teachers to give boys a masculine influence. China is trying to educate boys in hopes of inspiring a new generation of soldiers to protect them in an invasion. Meanwhile, the polarized lack of nationalism in America is actually attributing to record low recruitment rates in all branches of the U.S. military. While some countries are running from nationalism, others are embracing the idea of putting their country's need first. For 360 View, I'm Roxana Solano.
While history shows the dangers of nationalism in the past, Germany and Italy, has the world overcorrected? Now, China is putting themselves first at all costs and reaping the benefits. Meanwhile, the U.S., who for 4 years did have an America First policy, is now aligning with organizations who go against everything the United States was actually built on. America joined as a founding member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, all back in 1949 during the Cold War to form an alliance with other countries seeking protection from the Soviet Union. Now, NATO was originally supposed to be disbanded after the fall of Soviet Russia in 1991. But as Ukraine looks to join NATO, this could very well lead to World War III. America is now vowing to protect a country most Americans couldn't even point out on a map 6 months ago. Ukraine's bid to join NATO has garnered animosity from Turkey and Russia, all to launch an attack. And as the United States pours itself into conflict, should we actually be taking the lead from other countries like China and putting ourselves first? Robert Ross is a professor of political science at Boston College and associate at the Center for Chinese Studies at Harvard University and joins us to talk about nationalism in today's world. Thanks for joining us, Professor Ross.
My pleasure.
Okay, let's start with an organization like NATO as a whole. Have we learned nothing from the former ally and Axis powers and history?
Well, I do think that we are facing Russian intentions and Putin's intentions to use force to advance Russian power in Europe. So the question is how we respond. And is the appropriate way to respond is to beef up American presence and ground force presence in Europe? Is the appropriate way to respond to expand NATO to include Finland and Sweden? These are the issues at debate. But there is no question that Russia is changing the map of post-Cold War Europe to the detriment of NATO allies. That calls for some response, at least some response, to Russian activities in the Ukraine, the expansion of Russian power.
But is there a reason for NATO today? I mean, originally when that union was formed, it was meant to disband. And yet we have seen that not only not happen, we have seen more and more funds be poured into it, with the United States having the most. China actually has continued to grow by not being involved in those types of partnerships. So who has it right and who has it wrong?
Well, on the case of NATO and responding to the Ukraine, we can be grateful that NATO still exists. So there's an organization with the United States can participate in to respond to Russian activities in the Ukraine. Whether the United States should be taking the lead in NATO, whether it should be the front line in resisting Russian activities, or whether it should be France or Germany or Great Britain or other countries, that is a debate that's in question in the United States. Should the United States be focusing its activities in Europe at the detriment of its presence in Europe, or can the United States do two fronts at once? Now, you're right. The Chinese certainly are more restrained in international affairs. They are focused on East Asia. They are focused on expanding their influence and undermining American presence in East Asia. And to that end, they're building a very large navy with one focus in mind, and that's East Asia. The challenge in the United States is we're still active in civil wars in Syria, in Yemen, throughout the Middle East, and now we're involved in activities in Europe to resist Soviet activities in the Ukraine. Can the United States be involved in all these hostilities and focus on Asia simultaneously? That's the fundamental question facing American security policy.
Well, and that's very interesting because, you know, after this disastrous pullout that we've seen in Afghanistan, it seemed this administration was going to focus on putting America first. I mean, did we learn our lesson and not get involved with other countries' politics? As you mentioned, there's multiple theaters that the U.S. is involved in right now that doesn't necessarily have a direct correlation with American security. So does America really gain more from being a part of NATO than to stand our own? I mean, do we actually think NATO would come to the U.S.'s defense on our soil if ever challenged?
NATO certainly came to American defense with great commitment following the 9/11. So yes,
but they went to Afghanistan. They went to, that was in Afghanistan, when we know that Saudi Arabia was the one that was behind 9/11. So was that really to our defense?
Yes, you're asking about NATO, and wouldn't, if America were under attack, would they come to our defense? And they did come to our defense, and they did fight in Afghanistan. So yes, and the answer to your question is yes, they would. So again, the question is not so much whether the Russians pose a challenge to American security, because of course, since 1776, American security has depended on developments in Europe as much as they have depended on developments in Asia. The question is, how forward should America be? And the more forward America is, the less likely you'll see the French, the Germans, the British step up and defend their interests in Europe by themselves. America seemingly cannot do multiple wars in multiple regions simultaneously, and the fundamental challenge is China and Asia. Now understand, we have an interest in Asia too. It's not, it is stronger than our contemporary interest in Europe, because the Russians are less powerful and less of a threat to America. So it's America first, but what is first for America? It is defending American interests in Asia and our relationship with Japan and other countries there who are vital to American security interests in East Asia.
Well, it'll be interesting to see if China does decide to go in aggressively in East Asia, if they decide to go in, how NATO will respond, if they'll consider them to be an ally. But it's not only in regard to the military, it's also in regard to the pandemic. Because another organization, the World Health Organization, really botched the way it handled the COVID-19 pandemic across the globe. It did not properly, I think, investigate China's claims initially that the disease could not transfer between humans. Surprise, we've learned it can. And it advised against restricting travel from countries, which actually could have slowed the initial spread. And there seems to be this lack of transparency about finding the origins of COVID itself. Labs are looking more and more suspect. President Donald Trump severed ties with WHO. President Biden rejoined on day one in office. Should America continue to pump money into an organization that some say actually exists really just to serve China and its interest?
Well, we should not be surprised that the WTO is a political organization, for obviously they operate in international politics. And if they want access to other countries, whether it's in Africa, whether it's South Asia, whether it's Latin America, to promote health, global health, which America has an interest in, they're going to have to work with local governments. But if local governments find the WTO hostile to their interests, they can't get into those countries. So is the WTO political? Of course they are. No more, no less than any other international organization, whether it's the UN, whether it's the IMF, whether it's the WTO, all international organizations are political, including the World Health Organization. Now, you're absolutely right, the Chinese were less than transparent. They were slow to respond. In those circumstances, we want the WTO and China to learn as much as they can, even though it's not as much as we would like. It is far more beneficial for the United States to have some access to China rather than to have no access. So in these circumstances, should we be part of the WHO? Absolutely, because they're not only involved in China, they're involved in Africa. And as we well know, if we don't want Americans to become sick from COVID, we must prevent the spread of COVID around the world, because if it first occurs in Africa or India or Japan or China, it will ultimately end up in the United States. American health is a global issue, and the WHO is far better to deal with global health issues than simply the United States acting alone.
Well, that is one thing that we have learned from the pandemic, is how quickly one thing can spread and how quickly it can come over. But obviously, transparency is important. Now, China is a country, I think, that we can universally agree puts themselves first. The government cut all the red tape for buildings and continues to erect cities, really, honestly, without much care to the environment, even though they say they do. China continues to gain a larger influence in the world as it takes over America's spot as a world power. But also their education. They are taught to love their country, as one of China's main goals right now is to raise the next generation, not only of citizens, but soldiers. Is China's success with nationalism something that other countries should mirror? Or is this potentially going too far?
Well, the unity of the Chinese people behind their government is clearly a strength. And in the last decade or so, the United States has become increasingly polarized, with many people believing the American democracy in the United States, Americans believe this, that our democracy is illegitimate. And so we have to ask ourselves, what is causing this polarization in America rather than coming together to address national problems? And to some extent, this polarization reflects U.S. government policy, leadership speeches, speeches from members of Congress, members of the Senate, who are resisting creating a unified perspective on the legitimacy of American institutions. So you can say part of the problem is China and how they use their propaganda system, but then part of the problem is the U.S. leadership in Congress and the Senate, who disparage American democracy, who undermine our institutions, and that creates as much polarization and the absence of unity as anything else in this country.
Well, Professor Ross, I just hope that we could actually encourage more unity and encourage the good that's in this United States, where so many times we focus on the bad. I think that would play a good role in a future society. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your insight.
Thank you.
Now, after the break, we're going to look at Brexit and the current status. And if the vote was held today, would the nationalists still have the power to pass the vote when we come back?
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly, all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Beyond the fact that some people say, oh, it's just a rag. But it's not just a rag.
That's right.
It represents inequality.
We have a choice to make. You know, I'm not going to let you tell me you care about me if you care about the flag.
I wish somebody could just tell me why this sets their hair on fire.
Hatred, lynchings, beatings, poverty, white supremacy is just a disgusting emblem.
The people of Mississippi voted on a flag, and 65% of the people voted to keep the current flag.
Our purpose is to defend the good name of the Confederate soldier, because these monuments that you see everywhere are not, they're not monuments to the Confederate government. They're monuments to the soldiers, to the veterans.
You know, if we're gonna be offended by everything, every negative part of our history, we have to get rid of everything.
I look forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Welcome back to 360 View. I'm Scotty Nell Hughes. Now, Brexit took over national headlines as Britain tried to sever ties with the European Union. Now it looks like Scotland is following their lead. So to discuss, we want to bring in economist Dr. Richard Wolff. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Wolff.
Glad to be here, Nell. Thank you.
Okay, well, I want to hold off on Scotland for a moment. I want to start with Brexit. You know, this was the original I'm putting my country first plan as Britain voted to exit the EU. Now, this would prevent the United Kingdom from having to pay the European Union, as well as limit who can easily travel between the countries. Now, the sentiment was jump-started by a string of terrorism attacks in England. And this form of nationalism allowed Britain to protect themselves. So do you see this form of nationalism leading other countries to break out of pacts such as the EU, NATO, and even the United Nations?
Absolutely. Nationalism can go both ways. It always has historically. It has been progressive, assuming we all agree on what that means, roughly, and it has been regressive or reactionary. It depends on who's making use of it for what purpose. So, for example, with Brexit, there you had a group of politicians, a conservative party that had been in office for a while and that was looking that it was going to lose its position. England's situation since 2008 has been a decline by every important measure. And so a wing of the conservatives led by Mr. Boris Johnson decided that a kind of nationalism would allow the Conservative Party to hold on. And they were right. They guessed politically correctly. They went on a tear and they forced a vote, which they decided to have. And then they were off and broke away from Europe. I don't think anyone, including most of the people who supported it, would today tell you with enthusiasm that they were right. There's a lot of debate in London, to say the least, about whether that wasn't a political mistake. And by the same token, on the other side, you have Ukraine or places like that that are trying to go in a very different political direction, but seeing nationalism in their context as a way to do that. So Scotland is pushing again yet in another direction. Look, not so many days ago, the Republican Party meeting in Texas insisted on making a statement that they reserve the right for Texas to secede from the United States. So the notion of a nationalism defined at various different levels, whether it be a region like Scotland or Texas or a whole country, I think you're going to be seeing nationalism played with by all the political sides over the immediate future in lots of ways we will find surprising.
You know, Dr. Wolf, I love that you looked at this in both ways. On one hand, you have nationalism causing people to separate from the bigger organization. On the other hand, you have it causing to want to join the big organization. And it's amazing to think if the present time situations between the pandemic and obviously the war in Ukraine, if that same vote in Brexit was held today, if it would have the same results. But I do want to look at the Scotland role in all of this. 52% of people in Britain voted in favor of Brexit back in 2016. 38% of Scottish voters actually wanting to join their British counterparts in breaking away from the EU. So it was not Scotland in support of this. Now Scotland wants their population to have control of their own future and is planning a vote on becoming an independent country. All of this is scheduled for October of 2023. What does Scotland have to gain by declaring independence? And do you see this vote being more about having to join the EU as the number one leading factor?
I think what you're seeing in Scotland is two things coming together. And I'll try to be polite here. The animosity felt by large portions of the Scottish people toward the British, the English, is very old and runs very deep. So all the politicians in Scotland have known for a long time, their whole lives, that this is a very powerful reality that could be tapped. In the past, it was kept under wraps because the British Empire would not allow the thing to go anywhere. And the pressure from London was always, we're the economic center. You could never make it on your own, given the size of Scotland, given where England's whole economy is developed without Scotland having its own reality within it. What has changed now is that Brexit opens up the space to break away, and what the Scots could do is cut a deal with the rest of Europe, go the other direction, and then you'd have the irony that part of the British United Kingdom expressed its nationalism by breaking away from Europe, whereas another part of the United Kingdom, Scotland, expressed its nationalism by reconnecting and becoming part of the EU. That kind of a Scottish breakaway, well, that's a very different story and could be imagined economically in a way that kind of going it alone, literally, that's a hard sell to get even to the people there.
Well, Dr. Wolf, as the economic environment continues to decline and Europe becomes more strained, it will be interesting to see when countries go into self-preservation mode for themselves rather for the entire entity. Dr. Wolf, always great to talk to you. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Since when has it become wrong for the people of a country to not have pride in their homeland? Now, granted, having too much pride can be just as dangerous as Germany showed us in World War I and II. However, if you tell a good person they are bad enough times, at some point they begin to believe it and even act like it. The same can also be if you tell an entire nation they should not be proud of their history, their present, or what their future looks like. They eventually will believe it. Even more convincing is the fact that it is coming from the leadership of that country. Now, the ironic part is what a society should do when they're being told by their leaders that they are not good is hold those leaders accountable and ask why the leaders are not motivating or creating an environment for the people to be their best. But this is the only way the world's elite can get the strongest of nations to agree to a global agenda. Why else would you want to involve yourself unless you were being deceived to think you were less and you were at the mercy of others for help? A country being its very best does not automatically cause it to be a detriment to another. The more self-sustaining and successful a country can be on its own, the better it is for everyone else. Moving forward, it might be those nationalists who exist within a country who might be the best and only hope for preserving its existence in the future. This has been part one of our series on nationalism. Come back next time to discuss how nationalism is specifically affecting economies around the world. I'm Skynell Hughes with your 360 view of today's world news from around the globe. Thanks for watching.